going on? Welcome to Jays Talk Plus. Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz with you. No Blue Jays game last night, but despite that, we have a loaded show today. We're going to talk to Joe Siddle. We're going to talk to Doug Fox about some Blue Jays prospects. We're going to talk to David Adler of MLB StatCast. And we're going to talk to Ryan Dempster, former Tip O'Neill Award winner. Vlad received his Tip O'Neill on the weekend as the Canadian Baseball Player of the Year for 2024. One quick note before we get into that 1927 Yankees level list of guests. We broke down this series a little bit yesterday and how the playing time may shake out with Dalton Varsho and Anthony Santander on the IL. Something changed yesterday that changes that analysis a little bit. Zach Wheeler will not pitch in this series any longer. He is going to be placed on the paternity list because him and his wife are expecting any day now. So that will move Christopher Sanchez and Mick Abel up a day. It will also mean Jesus Luzardo, who gave up 417 runs on Saturday, it felt like, will pitch on Thursday, which for the purposes of figuring out the lineup configurations mean the Blue Jays will see two lefties this series and two lefties this week. The Twins, of course, are all righties. So it doesn't change much for the weekend, but how the Roden, Clase, Davis Schneider, Ernie Clement of it all shakes out might be a little different.
I have to imagine that everyone in the Blue Jays clubhouse is very happy for Zach Wheeler and his wife.
Yes. Congrats on the child. And you don't have to face one of the best pitchers of this generation later today. Christopher Sanchez, no slouch himself, but the Blue Jays are rolling. Let's talk to Joe Siddle about it. He is on color with Dan Schulman all week on the Blue Jays broadcast on Sportsnet. Dan, Joe, how are we doing?
I bet Dan's great and Joe's great too.
Good. Glad to hear it. Good morning. Off to a great start today, Joe.
Good morning. We're still getting used to the 2-hour show, you know, waking up an hour early. We're all feeling it, Joe.
Let's kick it off right here.
All right. Joe, speaking of kicking it off, right, the Blue Jays offense been humming a little bit here. Obviously against the Athletics, that was one thing. The bats are really there. But when you see the snapshot for the month of May, and Chris Black sends out the top sheet, and here are the numbers for May and the team's rankings, given that we were not far removed from that week against Tampa and Texas where they couldn't score at all, did that surprise you at all, just how well the Blue Jays offense graded out overall for the month of May?
Yeah, I think so. It was much improved from April, which it had to be. And we talked a lot throughout the course of April of how they had to get better. And, you know, it's still that up and down, right? You face some pretty good pitching. It's going to be tough. And you beat up on some pitching like the Athletics, which is what you want to do, what you had to do. I don't think I expected them to score the runs that they did score. But I think it's going to play out over time. I'm still not sure where this lineup is. I don't want to get too excited after what happened on the weekend. But as you stated, the month of May in general is pretty good. Like any team, I think, and I'm guilty of it, I'll raise my hand and say I get caught up sometimes when I see a good pitcher shut them down on a given night, when I see good velocity shut this lineup down over the course of 2 or 3 days. So you have to take those as snapshots, because I think when we've dug in a little deeper too, they've faced a pretty good pitch. They've faced lots of velocity. So that was maybe a bit of a reprieve on the weekend to get away from that. But we saw in Texas, you know, it's pretty good pitching, and it was tough to score runs. And we won't talk about Tampa anymore. We're just going to pretend that didn't even happen. But to come off a week where you're scoring 6 runs in 6 games and then to do that, I mean, you're talking about the two extremes within a couple of weeks there. It's just, I think this would be a good test. Phillies are a good team. They're not playing great right now. They've lost 4 in a row. We're not seeing Zach Wheeler. That's a welcoming news, and welcoming for he and his wife, it sounds like, too, as they're having a child. But, you know, this pitching, the starting rotation is pretty good in Philly, and you're going to see three pretty good ones. It sounds like we're going to see the kid come back up, yeah. Mick Abel. So that'll be fun to watch. Their bullpen issues are their bullpen issues. That seems to be an issue for those Phillies every year, but Dave Dombrowski is going to have to continue to address that. This lineup may have had a bit of a quiet week, but you just never know with these guys, right? Especially if Harper is back.
Oh, no. Dave Dombrowski's got to go make transactions. I'm sure he's so upset. He's got to hit the waiver wire or make some June trades here. You mentioned the quality of pitching there, Joe, and just a little stat that came out yesterday. So the team's OPS against pitchers who are above average this year by ERA, Jays are actually third in OPS. But it's 727. Those aren't big numbers. Most teams struggle against good pitchers, but they've done maybe a tiny bit better than it's felt.
Yeah, and I'm with you, Joe. I think that we should just stop talking about the Tampa series altogether. And really, I've been preaching that for a few days now. I'm glad that it's gaining some traction here. but something that we have seen even through the ups and downs here, is a lot of these guys, a lot of them, giving credit to the coaching staff. And that goes obviously beyond even David Popkins, right? I'd say it's still early to, and especially because of the ups and downs, to sort of define an identity for this offense. But what does it tell you when so many guys are saying, yeah, we need to give credit to these guys in order to put us in a good process, in a good routine, and to actually believe in what we're doing here?
Julia, I have a little grin on my face, as you see. And it's because when lineups are hitting, you hear a lot of wonderful things. Mm-hmm. And when they're not hitting, you don't hear a lot of wonderful yeah. things. And that's why it's really hard for me to grade coaches or evaluate coaches, because I don't want to give the hitting coaches all the credit when this lineup is humming, but I also don't want to blame them when they're not hitting. I don't think it's fair. I have no idea what's going on behind the scenes and in the video room and in the batting cage and everywhere. I don't doubt at all that they're doing everything they can on a daily basis to make these hitters better, to make this lineup better. And I'm sure that was the case throughout the month of April. Things have gotten better. That's great. And it's almost like talking to pitchers about a catcher. Do you think a pitcher's going to say, oh, he does a terrible job? No. So, I mean, let's put all of these things in perspective. I was a catcher for a million years. And when I talked about my starting pitcher that night, because you get interviewed as a catcher, you get interviewed after a game. I would like to be honest, but I'm also not going to bury my starting pitcher mm-hmm. because if he didn't have a great day, it'll be, what are we going to do his next start to be better, or if it's a reliever. So I take those things with a grain of salt, Julia. You know, I really have to. But I think we just watch the performance. And when you watch the performance, you're seeing a lot of good things. And I'm not saying just the A series. We're seeing more and more. I think we do know what this offense is. This offense is a contact-oriented offense that doesn't have a ton of swing and miss. They're disciplined. They'll take their walks. They're not going to strike out much. And the bazillion-dollar question is going to be, are they going to hit enough for power? So we'll see. Again, time will tell. It certainly wasn't a problem on the weekend, but it's a little different when you start seeing 96, 97 consistently that we have seen at times. And in saying all that, yes, Blake, you're right. You mentioned some, like it was Crochet. They've hit some very good pitching and some good velocity pitching. So we got to be careful not to do a little snapshot. We know some hitters have a good month, and then they have a bad month. We know some hitters have a good first half, and then they have a bad second half. Like the season is compartmentalized so many different ways, and it's such a marathon in baseball. It's just so different than all of the other sports.
Joe, this is an aside, but you mentioned there we talk to catchers, and we do. Tyler Heineman, relative to playing time, gets interviewed more often when we're in the clubhouse early on. You know, Alejandro Kirk, Danny Jansen, when he was here, even, you know, Caleb Joseph. I went down to spring training one time when he was with the Orioles, and I bugged him so much. I know this was, the media environment was different, but did you experience that as a player as well, like in the 90s, that you were a guy who obviously knew the pitching staff really well, catchers have to think the game and the opponent at such a high level? Were you getting kind of outsized requests even as a player?
Absolutely. Yeah, 100%. And I think they're kind of drawn to you. You know, Tyler Heineman's a perfect example. And you just mentioned him. You know, Dan and I had him in the booth there a couple of days ago on the weekend. He was wonderful. It was great. It was, you know, not unfortunately, but we were also really focusing on his injury and the concussion protocol, a very serious topic. So we probably couldn't have as much fun as we necessarily wanted to because of his insight into the game. It's fantastic. And yes, so after games, I remember in my Expos days, I mean, they would draw to you because, A, they probably, as you can see, you have that gift of gab. You're not afraid to talk. You're not afraid to analyze the game. And that's, as you people, everybody knows in media and writers back in the Jeff Blair days. Jeff Blair was writing for the Montreal Gazette when I was at the Expos. But I remember Felipe Alou, he would tell reporters that, you know, he's going to be a good manager one day. Well, I didn't become a manager, but similar to it, just be involved in the game, talking the game and the broadcasting nature of it. So yeah, it did happen way back then. So a lot of that has not changed at all.
Yeah, I was going to say that it probably helped, right? And it probably still does with what you're doing right now. And that's great because we are all very appreciative to have you on the team, Joe. And just
Jeff Blair too. Fascinating career story and career 100%. Path for him going from Winnipeg and the Blue Bombers to the Montreal Gazette and everything and landing here now.
Who knows how people are going to talk about us, right? In 20 years or whatever it may be. But just going back to this iteration of the Blue Jays really quickly, you did mention, Joe, some hitters have good months and then bad months, good first halves, but good or bad second halves or whatever. But what we're seeing right now from Madison Bargers interests me in that way. he didn't perform to the level that the Blue Jays expected him to last year, didn't perform to the level that they expected him to early on this year. And now all of a sudden we're witnessing the breakout of this very important player who could be an important bat for this lineup moving forward. What are you seeing from him right now? What has changed that has allowed Addison Barger to tap into the potential for real?
Well, I think he's that one guy that even like throughout spring training, and we talked about the one acquisition of a hitter in Santander, and could they have used two bats and on, we kept saying like somebody else has to pop. Somebody else has to be that breakthrough guy that in July or August we're talking about as like, wow, maybe an all-star just really coming out. And I think he's the guy right now. And again, it's still very early because what I'm liking is that consistency of the way he's hitting the baseball. I mean, you look at the hard contact, it doesn't lie. Now, hitting the ball out of the park like he did 3 days in a row, that's very impressive. Again, it's the athletics, but you still got to hit it. He's doing damage against those mistakes. He's getting pitches out over the plate and doing damage. And the reason I'm always cautiously optimistic about young players like this is because they're getting around the league. You know, he got his feet wet last year, and that's always difficult for a young player coming up because they have a ton of information on you. They're going to figure you out quickly, and they're going to attack your weaknesses. And we know he's worked on some mechanical changes from last year then to this year. In spring training, he told me that they just got back to him and said, you know what, let's get back to the way you were last year, a little bit more athletic in the batter's box, open and more upright and narrow. And he's a tremendous athlete, obviously. Now, I think we'll see if he can handle the velocity. Like, we're going to probably see teams attack him with more velocity, and we'll probably also see them attack him with more spin. He hit a nice fastball out over the plate, but he also hit a hanging splitter. So some of those things we'll see moving forward. And that's why, again, it's 1st of June here. Mm-hmm. We'll see what opposing teams keep doing to him and if he can make the adjustment back. But, I mean, my goodness, so far so good. And that's what you want to see. He's basically taken the third base job and run with it. Now, there will be a lot of lineup construction questions moving forward here. But bottom line is you want him in the lineup every day because it's a very dangerous at-bat every time he steps to the plate.
Absolutely it is. And you mentioned some of the mechanical changes with the openness of the stance, the narrowness of the stance. Great thread from Chris Black at Down to Black on Twitter yesterday using some of those new metrics we have to try to visualize that for Barger there as well. And Joe, on Barger, obviously the exit velocities, how hard he hits the ball and things like that, really, really impressive. But when you look and you know, normally, especially with a young player who has a loud swing like that and makes loud contact, I think sometimes, at least I associate, I'm going to expect to see some swing and miss. I'm going to expect to see some chase in a profile like that with a young player. When you look at Barger and those things aren't extreme, they're even a little above average. I know we've got to see the velocity in and stuff like that, but the fact that he doesn't expand the zone too much, that there isn't a ton of swing and miss, even with how powerful the swing is, how much extra kind of confidence does that give you that he will be able to figure out those next level adjustments out?
Yeah, it's a great sign because I call it like a kind of a controlled violence because it's a violent swing. Everything he does is like 100%. And when he throws a baseball, when he runs, and when he turns around first base, and then of course, when he swings the bat, he does not get cheated, but it's controlled. And the reason I say it's controlled is because he is obviously seeing the ball well and to do those things that you just described. Those are great things. Think of like the other extreme, maybe like a Kirk from the right side. And again, not a violent necessarily swing like Addison's, but just really commands the zone, really has a good knowledge of the strikes and just dares you to go ahead and throw those sliders just off the plate away because I'm not swinging and I'm going to get in a good count and I'm going to get the fastball that you're going to feed me. So if he can continue to do that, help himself get into good counts, because you get a reputation really, really fast. And you just rattled up like numbers tell a huge story. And if you're going to be chasing changeups down and away, if you're going to be chasing spin, they'll keep feeding it to you. So that's a good sign. I always use Kirk's name when I talk on this topic because it's like he just gives you such a good plate appearance every time. It's like I don't know if he ever really throws away an at-bat. Like he is just because of the way he commands the zone and, of course, the way he's swinging bat right now, he just looks so strong. But that's Barger right now. And because of the damage potential, I thought – last year when I saw him, the one thing is there are times you'll see those hips really kind of fly open. It looks like he kind of gets a little bit too pulley, you know, that pull mode and around the baseball. But then this year we've seen him also shoot some balls into the left center gap with authority. Mm-hmm. That's a really good sign to stay on pitches maybe that are on the outer half because now you're not. Now he took that home run on that fastball on the outside part of the plate. the other day and pulled it, but you can do that too. So those are things to keep an eye on. And also, more importantly, keep an eye on how other teams are pitching them, because that to me is, that tells everything, especially when you face good pitching teams. How they pitch you speaks volumes and what they think about your swing.
When you talk about controlling the strike zone and actually looking for your pitch, not chasing it, my mind goes to Davis Schneider. We had him on the show last week, and basically what he said was, I got away from myself. I got away from my approach. I was chasing the spin. I was chasing stuff out of the zone, which is not my game, right? So the directive, I guess, was simple when he went down to AAA, is just get back to who you are and what's made you good in the past. And when we see a guy like that come back, even an Alan Roden, who had a chance early on, couldn't really make the most of it. Obviously, very different hitting profiles there. But sure. Now we're going to see more of them, just, you know, by nature of injuries and roster construction and all of that. But what are you looking for from each of those guys as they get a bit more of an opportunity here?
Well, some form of consistency, right? So that you're not seeing a lot of what you've been continuing to see. And, you know, with Davis, oftentimes it's the swing and miss, the ball's away, the ball's up. And you can say, work on what you are best at. And if you're best middle in, the problem with that is that big league pitchers, and of course they miss their spots too, but they're also a little bit more consistent with hammering your weaknesses. So guess what you're getting? You're going to continue to get those elevated fastballs. You're going to continue to get those sliders on the outer part of the plate or fastballs away. So you do have to find a way to manipulate your swing or your swing mechanics, not fix them, but alter them to adjust to big league pitching. Otherwise you're not going to survive. And that's where I think, you know, we've seen some great things from Davis Schneider, and hopefully we'll see a lot more. Mm-hmm. But this test up here right now will be another test in that regard. So often you see guys go down to AAA and they dominate and they do some great things. And I just think there's that one level. It's not just one level, because you're up here, you're seeing so much more, I think, consistent velocity, the movement. And I would say location too, even though, again, I don't want to make it sound like big league pitchers don't miss their spots. Of course they do. But those are the things. And with Alan, in spring training, I just thought he looked so different. So I'm not sure what happened when the season started, if he altered his swing. But between the two of them, you got Schneider from the right side, Roden from the left side, very different swings, yes. But you have to adjust and be who you are and what you do best. But at the same, and I'm not saying you have to cover the whole zone. But at the same time, I mean, if you don't try to cover an area that's your weakness, you're going to get eaten up, I think, at this level, because they're going to hit their spots plenty enough that you're going to struggle.
On the other side of things, this is a difficult Phillies team. They got swept on the weekend, but they've been one of the best teams in baseball so far. Probably the most interesting part to me, and we're going to talk to him at 3:00 today down in the Phillies dugout. Jordan Romano's back. He's obviously had a little bit of up and down so far this season, but that's a guy, really great Toronto Blue Jays career. How excited are you to catch up with him and see him back here as an opposing pitcher?
Yeah, Jordan's a funny guy, great guy, and he was a lot of fun to cover here as a Blue Jay, and it's almost hard to believe he's not a Blue Jay anymore. And I wish him the best, aside from these 3 days coming up, but he had a little bumpy road early on too, and we've seen that, and we've seen it with Jeff Hoffman on this side. And I feel for, as a catcher, I always felt for relief pitchers in general, but especially closers, because when you have a bad one or two, it can wreck your month. And you pitchers can say that they ignore the numbers. They don't ignore the numbers. They see the numbers just like we do. So when your ERA goes from 2 to 5 in one outing, it's not a lot of fun. And as relievers, it takes a long time to get those numbers back. The nice thing about closers, and Hoffman's probably a perfect example here, is you don't need to look at the ERA. Just look at the saves. How many games are you coming in saving? Because if you blow it, you blow it. Whether you give up 2 or you give up 7, it doesn't really matter. So every single time you come in for that save, it is just, it's like a new season. And I know, psychologically as a catcher, that's what you do with your pitchers, especially after coming back from a bad one or a bad couple. So I'm sure Jeff's going through it. I'm sure Jordan's going through it. As I said, maybe they won't need Jordan Romano this series. Wouldn't that be even better? But yes, look forward to seeing him as well. What a dream come true must have been for him, pitching basically at home like this in the big leagues.
Yeah, and on that vein, I guess we can also talk about Bowden Francis, right? Who had a couple of he's had a tough stretch, I will say. Yeah. He bounced back a little bit in his past start for sure. This is a very dangerous Phillies lineup that is about to get Bryce Harper back. as you look at Bowden Francis, and all keeping in mind that he's probably only going to see this lineup twice and then he's going to get pulled from the game, what are you looking for in terms of consistency and results from him?
Looking for life on that fastball. I mean, how many times did we cover those games last year? And, you know, people talk about location and velocity. I don't look at the numbers. I don't look at the location. I look at what hitters are doing to his fastball because it tells you everything. Whether it's 93 right down the middle or 95 on the corner, I don't think he's not painting corners. That's not who he is. He's using the life on his fastball. And I say life on his fastball, whether it's the ball, the way it's coming out of his hand, deceptive delivery, spin rate, on and on and on. I'm not going to get into all those metrics. I don't understand all of them, but I know when he throws 93 down the middle, like he did a lot last year and guys weren't getting to it, I was mystified. Mm-hmm. And what it tells me is that that ball is doing something. And we're just not seeing that this year. I talked to him about it the other day after his last start in Texas. And I said, did you go into that game thinking you're going to use the fastball as much as you did? And he said, no, not really. And I said, so what made it change? As you evolve sometimes during a game, you see what's happening. And it was a catcher calling a game. You see what's happening and you kind of go to plan B maybe. Well, in this case, it wasn't going to plan B because something wasn't working. It was going to plan B because something was working. So the fastball was great. They weren't getting to it. Not a great lineup, the Rangers, and you're playing in a big ballpark. It was almost like, here you go. Hit it as far as you can because it's probably not going to leave the yard. So it worked for him. Now, I asked him, is there a difference between what he's doing now and earlier in the season? And you know, Bowden with his great answers, it's kind of that little, not really. Like, I just need time. The weather's heating up, so I'm going to heat up now.
Perfect.
But, you know, I the reason I initiated the question was because I said, is it anything to do with your workload last year? You know, I don't know if you necessarily feel the fatigue or, but he said, no, it just takes me time to get going. Mm-hmm. So we'll see. It's June, so hopefully he can get going. But I think that's something to look for tonight against this lineup, especially because when that has its life, it can help your secondary pitches. And we know they've been getting hammered too. So that's what's, if the fastball is working and has life, I think it'll help the curveball, the splitter. And those pitchers need help right now.
Yeah, we'll see. If it's a conversation as to whether he can go a third time through the order, you're in a good place. Because Stott, Turner, Harper, Schwarber at the top, I don't think you're getting a third time through unless you're borderline no-hitting. Joe, thanks so much for taking the time out, man. Really appreciate you doing this.
All right, Blake, Julie, have a great day. We'll see you down at the ballpark.
All right, Joe Siddall on the call with Dan Schulman for this series as well as the weekend series against the Minnesota Twins on Sportsnet. And yeah, he mentioned, you know, kind of the spin rate stuff, and him and I were actually kicking around off air before his last start,
right?
Because the spin rate had been down, and you know, Joe kind of asked, like, is this anything, what's like a significant change in the spin rate? And it was like it was up last game, and mm-hmm. you want that on the fastball, even though he's got kind of a low spin splitter, but there wasn't really that much different in the underlying profile last time out. It was a lot of the fastball was up a little bit in terms of velocity, but like Joe said, there's a lot of location stuff and how you're using it. And he ended up, I think that start ended up the highest fastball use of any start in his career.
Wow.
So
really?
I believe so. Yeah. I'd have to double check that, but I'm pretty sure that's when I did my research coming into the show off his last start. So that'll be interesting to see. And this is a difficult top of the Phillies lineup.
Very much
I guess
so.
The one nice thing is, like, because Bryson Stott and Trey Turner are around now, like, they used to have Kyle Schwarber lead off, and I can't imagine anything worse as a right-handed pitcher who has some home run problems than having to face Kyle Schwarber in the leadoff spot. At least now he's down. He's been hitting 2-3-4, depending on the handedness of the pitcher,
right,
and who's available and things like that. But as we mentioned off the top, Bryce Harper is expected back. He's missed the last five games after taking a Spencer Strider fastball off the elbow that would turn either of us to dust, but Bryce Harper just needs a week.
Just needed some days to recover. Listen, this is a powerful lineup. I know that they've been maybe not playing to their capabilities right now, but all you need is one game to sort of get it right and get it back together. And there's a lot of power there against a pitcher that has allowed a lot of home runs already.
Yes. And it's also one of those things, like, at least I find with a more veteran team, even when guys aren't hitting that well, you still, like, the stress level of going through that lineup of facing, I mean, Nick Castellanos is hitting pretty well lately, but as an example, if he's not hitting that well, he's still Nick Castellanos.
Right on.
Max Kepler, you know, maybe not a household name, but as a platoon guy, a really dangerous guy to have in the bottom third of your order. JT Realmuto is hitting eighth.
Yes.
There's a depth here to the lineup that is, you know, it's a stressful 1-9 there, I think. Let's take a break.
Yes. I think it's
there
time.
Was no Jays game yesterday. There were a few minor league games, including Adam Mako making his latest start as he works his way back. He's now pitched 14 innings with only 5 earned runs over 4 FCL starts. Landon Marotas is down in the FCL rehabbing as well. Johnny King had another good outing. He's a prospect who's got a little helium as complex league games pick up here. The Dominican Summer League started yesterday as well. We will not be doing deep dives on those guys because we don't have access to the video, and most of them are like 17 years old, and who knows what those guys will be. But at the higher level of the minor leagues, the Blue Jays system is performing a little better than maybe the industry average belief had them performing heading into this year. The teams aren't winning a ton, but at the individual level, Yohindrick Panango, RJ Schreck, Trey Savage, Gage Stanifer, and Cal Steven, who are now up in high A. There are a lot of success stories going on in this first third of the season, so let's take a break. Let's talk to Doug Fox, who writes the Future Blue Jays newsletter that you find in your inbox about once a week. Let's go deep on some of these names in the system. We'll also do some CanCon. Sam Shaw, one of the hottest hitters. Victoria's own Sam Shaw. We'll do that. David Adler and Ryan Dempster will join us in the second half. We'll get you further set up for the Phillies series with Dempster, and we'll go around Major League Baseball with Adler. And we'll talk some Athletes Unlimited Softball League, something George Springer is very excited about.
Yes,
we got a loaded show.
That.
I should stop talking, take a break. Let's talk to Doug Fox as Jays Talk Plus continues with Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz.
Big opinions and in-depth conversations covering the Leafs, Jays, Raptors, and the NFL. The J.D. Bunkin Podcast. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz with you. It's time to go down on the farm. It's time to talk to Doug Fox of the Future Blue Jays newsletter, also author of On Account of Darkness, The Halleyites, Severn Sound, one of our favorite guests. And Doug, I remember the last time you came on Zoom, your wife gave you a bit of grief after for the shirt you were wearing in the setup. You look extremely professional today. Welcome.
Thank you so much, and I hope you guys are enjoying that lovely smoke-infused Ontario air right now.
Oh, yeah. It's been not great, but also I think we've kind of come to expect it at this time of year. It's sad, but it's true, right?
Yes, it is. Yep.
Yeah. I don't know what you guys are talking about. My sinuses and lungs are just wrecked at this point. Anyway, pollen counts through the roof. Maybe I should go down to Buffalo. Maybe it'll be a little better there. Doug, let's go down to Buffalo, where the Bisons have recently been joined by Yohindrick Panango, 23-year-old, picked up in the Nate Pearson trade last year. Was an interesting guy at deadline time. Baseball America had him in the 500 to 1250 range, which they don't actually rank all the individual prospects that far. But basically, he's a notable guy, but not a top prospect. He was doing his fourth year at high A ball at that point, and now he's ranked at double A. He's gotten promoted to triple A. You tweeted out the stats of the Jays minor league system leaders so far this year yesterday. He has the top OPS of any full season player so far. What are you seeing with Panango? What are you hearing about Panango here?
He's definitely a bat first player with more of a contact over power profile. But until RJ Schreck heated up this month, Panango was pretty much the sole offensive threat in New Hampshire's lineup. So I'm not sure, given the guys who are going to be coming off the IL for the Blue Jays shortly, hopefully, I'm not sure his stay in AAA is going to be a long one because the outfield situation is a little bit crowded there. But it'll be interesting to see how Panango does against the higher level pitching. The knock on him, from what I've read and what I've been told, is that his swing can get to be a little bit long. And so there are some who are not sure that he's going to be able to adjust to velocity at the higher levels, but he's certainly earned that shot. And when you consider what the Blue Jays gave up to get him and I believe Josh Rivera, who has solidified Buffalo's infield defense while a couple of guys were hurt, that's a pretty decent return.
Yeah, Nate Pearson, who Davis Schneider was hitting off of the other day when we had him on the show, and there was a clip airing. With Panango, you mentioned the swing length and maybe some issues with velocity, but at the time that he was picked up, I believe Jeff Ponce was on with us and called him a data darling. Like, the exit velocities are crazy. There are, you know, this year he has 8 home runs, which is close to the organizational lead, but in general, it hadn't resulted in a ton of home run pop just yet. And the The comp that I heard most often, not in terms of specifically their style of play, but where he may end up in terms of like his value and his role, is a Davis Schneider-ish one. Mm-hmm. Doesn't have a natural position, hits the ball really hard, so there's enough to like there, but probably going to strike out a lot. Do you think that's a fair, again, not similar looking players in the box or anything like that, but in terms of where they could end up at the end of their development?
Absolutely. A little bit more pop would be nice, but the thing I like from a non-analytic standpoint right now, and having seen a number of his at-bats this year, he's locked in at the plate. He is seeing the ball really, really well, and he's picking up spin, and he's not chasing. And despite the length of that swing that we talked about, you know, those are traits that are going to stand him well at the upper levels. Is he a big league prospect? He's more of a fringe guy, but sometimes guys find their way into the big leagues, maybe with the Blue Jays, maybe with another organization, maybe it takes them a couple of tries, but there are guys who kind of carve out careers in that kind of role. Wouldn't surprise me if he did that. Just the odds are long considering the outfield competition already ahead of him.
Doug, you another guy that came into the system via trade is RJ Schreck, who honestly, I just want to see him make it to the majors so that I can say Schreck repeatedly. It's, I think it's good enough reason, but he has also been one of the best hitters of this system right now. 9 home runs already. When you look at a guy that comes in via a trade for Justin Turner, it's not really a super highly touted prospect, but he seems to be impressing. We even saw him in big league camp a little bit this year. What do you make of where RJ Schreck is right now?
I love the way Schreck has turned his season around. Now, just a precursor to that is this is my 13th year of watching the Blue Jays farm system and writing about it. I have not seen a spring colder and wetter than this one. Mm-hmm. And what that means for ball players is because they're such creatures of habit, it means an interruption to their daily routines. That means they're not getting reps on a regular basis. And a lot of players struggled in April. Schreck had a 481 OPS for April, but he's turned things around in May, a 1081 OPS. What I like about Schreck is his swing. It's short, it's compact, it's to the ball. He has a feel for the barrel. It is probably one of the prettiest swings in the organization. And on the strength of that alone, I think that will play at the higher levels as well. Certainly another one of those guys who's a fringe prospect, but he's certainly, you'd have to think, when there's another opening in the outfield in Buffalo, whenever that may be, probably later in the season, there's a guy that definitely should get a look. But he is certainly, he's caught fire this month. He has been the hottest hitter in the system for the month of May.
Yeah, a lot of walks, good reports, and good underlying stats with respect to his discipline. And the 9 homers are probably most notable to me. Yeah. Fangraphs only had him with a 40 grade. Yeah. Potential
a
future value.
Surprising, for sure.
Yeah, in terms of power. And he hit 17 last year over a couple different levels, but 9 in a hurry is nice to see there. Gonna do one more guy they got in a trade. And this is one I would guess. I should have saved this one for a trivia one, actually, is in what trade did the Blue Jays pick up Edward Duran, who is repeating at Single-A Dunedin? And the answer is he was the player to be named later in Jordan Groshans for Zach Pop, Anthony Bass, and player to be named later. Bass and Pop, of course, no longer in the organization. Jordan Groshans had been waived, claimed, traded, and is now with Kansas City's Double-A team. So not a lot out of this trade has been all that meaningful just yet. But Edward Duran, 21-year-old catcher who plays a little bit of first base as well. Doug, he is on a 22-game hit streak, which seems ridiculous for a 21-year-old at any level. Not sure how much you've gotten to see him or how much you've talked to people in the Blue Jays organization about him, but is he someone who should have, should get bumped up from that honorable mention in the kind of 40-ish range in terms of prospects to someone with maybe a higher level of interest moving up, especially at a position where, at catcher, where the Blue Jays do not have a lot of top-flight prospects right now?
Absolutely, and he's a guy I've been paying a lot of attention to. He had a hit in every game he appeared in this month, so that's the 22 games right there. He really reconfigured his body in the offseason. He was doing a lot of two-a-days. I think the Blue Jays, with their exit interviews after last season, one of the things they talked to him about is he needed to take his strength and his conditioning a lot more seriously, and he did. He had a fantastic spring from all accounts. He's worked diligently on his defense. Dunedin pitchers love throwing to him, and he's already demonstrated good blocking, framing. Not that you have to do very much framing in the Florida State League because of the ABS system. Receiving skills, game management, working with pitchers, in addition to the offense, which is kind of a bonus. The Blue Jays are not overloaded with catching prospects at the moment, but they are, let's say, there are guys who they paid a little bit more of a price, like I'm thinking of a Jacob Sharp, maybe to bring into the organization. And Aaron Parker, sixth-round pick, he needs to play every day, so he's at Vancouver. But I think Duran has certainly earned a promotion, and I expect that we'll see that by the end of the month. I jokingly call him the catcher of the future with a question mark on social media, and it's still too early to really give him that label, but he has been the biggest surprise in the system this season, without a doubt.
Yeah, not since Gabriel Moreno, right? Have we seen a true catching prospect from...
I'm still broken from Curtis Thigpen and Guillermo Quiroz. And, you know, I've had so many catchers of the futures.
There's been a lot. There's been a lot. And it's interesting, right? And Blake, you had this question in the doc here, and I think it's a very fascinating one in that... Why have the Blue Jays struggled to sort of develop catchers? I know that it's a difficult position to even, you know, find it. It is a difficult position to develop, period. But it's been a little bit now, you know, since Kirk, Jansen, and Moreno. And this is kind of where we are still. Can you pinpoint, did you have a theory here, Doug, as to why that is?
I think it has to do more with the changing perception among analytics people of the nature of the position. I mean, you know, take a look at me, and I'm a guy who grew up with Johnny Bench, Carlton Fisk, Gary Carter as the catchers that were the prototypical for their time. But I think as time has progressed and we have a much more data-driven approach to the game, catchers, they have tremendous value in their defensive skills, not just that behind the plate, but in managing the game, working with the pitchers, all of the stuff that we don't always necessarily see. And so offense, I wouldn't say that it's secondary, because you do have to hit at a certain level. But I think teams are willing to punt a little bit on a guy who's going to hit seventh or eighth in your order, but he's going to save runs on defense. So I think, if you take a look around the game, I think that's more you see. Like, I don't know when we'll see a Salvador Perez even for the next little while. And even Moreno is more lauded for his defensive work ahead of his offensive work. So I think that maybe the age of a catcher like Johnny Bench or a Carlton Fisk getting an MVP award on the strength of their offense, maybe those days are behind us, at least for now. So I think that's really what it is. And I think the other thing is that catchers have a very long development period compared to a lot of other prospects. And so I think I think just through attrition, you see a lot of washout. But the Blue Jays certainly aren't alone in that regard. But you take a look around, I was looking around the Eastern League standings and just looking at catchers the other night, and here's one guy hitting 181, another guy hitting 136. So I think it's very much the way the position is now.
Yeah, and Duran's an interesting one because he's allowed, quote-unquote, a lot of stolen bases, but everyone runs like crazy in the Florida State League, so he's also caught a really good number of guys. He's caught more than 25% of base stealers, so when you see, oh, he's allowed 59 stolen bases, like, yeah, but he's caught like a quarter of them. That it's the league context there is really tough. Wanted to ask you about one more hitter before we talk about some of the spicy pitching names. Just got to get a little Canadian content in here. Sam Shaw, 20-year-old second baseman who's played all three outfield positions as well, spent the last year and a half in the complex league after being drafted with an above slot bonus, by the way, in the ninth round in 2023. So obviously a guy they wanted to get in the org. He's seeing single A ball for the first time here and just great numbers. 158 weighted runs created plus, so about 60% better than a league average hitter at that level. Hitting almost 300, walking almost 20% of the time, big line drive rate. What do you like about Sam Shaw, the Victoria product?
I like how he gives Dunedin broadcaster Eli Fishman a chance to give his listeners and viewers a Canadian geography lesson. every game that he plays while Eli explains where Victoria is and Vancouver Island. And kudos to Eli for that. He knows his Canadian geography. Shaw, the Blue Jays loved his approach before they had even drafted him. They were thrilled to get him. Being a Canadian kid, maybe behind his American and international counterparts in terms of development. So that's why we saw him take a little bit longer to reach the level that he's at right now. But I think he's certainly proven everything that he can in the Florida State League. He gets on base. He drives the ball. Every time, if I'm not watching the game, I'm checking the box score the next day, and he's got two hits. Mm-hmm. I've lost track of the number of multi-hit games he has. 432 on base percentage. We're approaching video game numbers with that. And I think he's starting to turn himself into a decent second baseman. The knock was always on him is, where is his home going to be? He's definitely a bat-first player. But man, he needs to go home to British Columbia. The fans in Vancouver need to see him. And we'll get a better idea for Edward Durant as well. And as we're getting with the pitchers who are in Vancouver right now, that one of the biggest things I have noticed, again, in my time in watching minor league baseball, is because we've eliminated a level, single A, just the breadth of skill level in single A is much bigger than it used to be. And so sometimes you have to take, I think, results from single A with a grain of salt, because you've got, an 18-year-old Arjun Namala last year in there, maybe before he was ready, and teams with only 150 some odd players they can have on their rosters now. We're seeing teams make decisions on players a lot earlier than they did before, and sometimes they're moving up through the system without a ton of skills. So I think high A is where we're going to start to get a better read on some of these guys. Shaw's approach, he doesn't chase. He hammers mistakes. Good, clean mechanics at the plate. I fully expect that's going to translate to the next level. And the Blue Jays are certainly going to take their time with his development, but he is one of the players that I'm really excited about. And I guess next to Durant, the best development story among hitters in the system so far.
And I love how you called Sam Shaw a dirtbag in the most loving way, right? A guy whose uniform is always dirty. And it seems like the personality is also developing alongside the game here. I'm sure that's also fascinating to watch, and I'm sure that's something that the BC crowd will appreciate as well.
Absolutely. As a former Blue Jays prospector or broadcaster used to say, he's a gamer.
That's a great way. Hopefully he's at the Nat in Vancouver soon, where he'll be playing alongside three of the most interesting pitching prospects in the Blue Jays system, in Trey Savage, Gage Stanifer, and Cal Steven. They all got the promotion the other week. So far, so good. Trey Savage has a 48% strikeout rate since the bump. He's also something that gets lost in how many bats he misses. He also has consistently had high ground ball rates since he got into pro ball here. But I think we've talked about Trey Savage a lot, and people have a familiarity with that. So I want to start by asking you about Gage Stanifer, who is not a first-round pick. He was a 19th-round pick in 2022. His ERA is not quite as sparkly as Trey Savage's, but the strikeout rate is right there. The whiff rate is right there. Another guy who generates some good ground balls. What is it? Like, Savage, we know. First-round pick, big program. With Stanifer from 10,000 feet, it's a little harder to grasp. Why is he so difficult to hit against? What have you seen with Stanifer, both at Dunedin and Vancouver, Doug?
What a great drafting and development story.
Yeah.
Stanifer is still a long way away, but the Blue Jays, I know from conversations I've had with people in the organization there, they're thrilled because he's put the work in, and he's got the foundation. He's at a different stage in his development than Savage would be, or even Cal Steven. But I could make the argument that he has been the best pitching prospect in the system so far this season. As to what makes him so difficult, I think a couple of things. He works really fast. He actually, in his last outing on the weekend, he first got a warning from the home plate umpire because he was already into the windup before the hitter was set in the box. And a few pitches later, he did it again. And so it was called an automatic ball. But I love that. I love that aggressiveness. Reminds me of Mark Burley. Just get the ball back, get on the rubber, get the sign, get ready to go. That starts to make the at-bat uncomfortable for the hitter. The other thing would be his short arm stroke. Hitters are just, they have trouble picking up that ball coming out of his hand because it comes not from down behind his back, but from just almost behind his ear. And then it starts coming in at 95 miles an hour, and he has a wipeout slider. And this guy is just a bulldog. On the, Chris George, is the, one of the C's broadcasters, was saying this weekend when Gage was in high school and playing high school football, he needed to bulk up. So he went on a 7,500 calorie a day diet.
Come on.
Wow.
For one football season. And I cannot imagine a teenage metabolism being far better, different than mine. But I think that just speaks to his nature. He is definitely a bulldog on the mound. And he has really, he makes hitters uncomfortable. They have a great, I mean, just like the same with your Savage, a great deal of difficulty squaring him up. But I think it's just that, that quick pace that he works with, and that, that arm slot just makes it, especially on a right-handed hitter, is really tough.
Yeah, that'll be very interesting to see. And him and Yasavage piggybacking each start means that's a day you can lock in on the Canadians' calendar that you need to be on MILB TV, especially now that the weather's turning a little bit here in Vancouver. No longer in Vancouver. Last one we'll ask you about here before we let you get on with your day, Doug. I know you got a new puppy, too, that, that probably is scratched at the door and wants some attention.
She's sleeping right now.
Nice, perfect. Jerome Watts-Brown got the bump from high A to double A. So we didn't get to see all these guys together, but New Hampshire needed some help as well. This is a guy who was a third round pick 2 years ago, got the big $1 million bonus, came in with really good grades on the slider and curveball, but some questions about, is that a reliever profile? The command isn't maybe elite, and the strikeout numbers have been ridiculous so far, just like the trio of other guys. But what have you seen from him? He's made two starts at double A now, and I know you had some thoughts on how he's looked. 4.91 ERA, but maybe a little more going on there.
Just one thought just before I get into that, and because I know Cal Steven is probably having a little bit of trouble, and even Savage, who walked four in his last start, had. When guys come up from the Florida State League to the Northwest League, there's no ABS system, right? Mm. There's no challenge system, which I think it's high time we have in Major League Baseball, because it now works so seamlessly in the minors. But the number one thing that the people throughout baseball have told me is leagues where there is the challenge system, everybody knows the strike zone better. And then you get to high A, and there is no system yet in the Northwest League. And so people don't seem to know the strike zone as much. Hitters don't tend to chase as much. But I'm finding with all three guys who came up to Vancouver, there was a bit of an adjustment at first because pitches that were getting called strikes in the Florida State League weren't necessarily getting called in the Northwest League. And I can't quantify that. I haven't had lengthy conversations with anybody about that, but that's just an observation from watching several outings from all three that I've noticed. As for Jerome Watts-Brown, when a guy has that kind of breakthrough, and he probably is the breakthrough pitching prospect, or 1A and 1B with Stanford, sometimes it's a mechanical adjustment. Sometimes it's what they did, like Edward Duran, in their offseason. But spoke with Ricky Meinhold, the Blue Jays minor league pitching coordinator, and he said it was mindset. What Jerome started to do this year was attack hitters more. Understand that he didn't have to live necessarily on the margins, paint the corners. He could come in a little bit and expand his strike zone a little bit, and that seems to have made all the difference in the world. And he was, just up until recently, when passed by one Trey Yasavage, he was leading the minor leagues in strikeouts and in strikeout rate. So the stuff has always been there. Questions about his athleticism, but I think he has worked on that. Fields his position really, really well. Long-term, is he a starter or a reliever? I still don't think I have an answer to that one yet, but you have to be impressed with the number of bats that he's missed. He's pretty much, in his first start with New Hampshire, he was a bit of a victim of that very short right field wall at Delta Dental Stadium in Manchester, and he's not the first pitcher that's happened to. Had a much better second start, and I suspect he's going to just continue on. Very interesting to see where he finishes the season as well, but just a great story about attacking hitters.
That's really great. It'll be interesting to see, and again, interesting to watch how, as the sample grows of him being a pretty effective starter, if the scouting take that he's maybe a reliever by the time he gets to the majors holds up, or if he can kind of fight that off a little bit. Either way, two big swing and miss breaking balls, you're going to be you're probably going to be okay in some role or another. Doug, thanks so much for doing this, man. Great to have you on for the first time this season. Looking forward to doing it some more.
Thank you both. Thanks for having me.
Doug Fox, it's the Future Blue Jays newsletter, which you can subscribe to. You can check out his social medias or just Google Future Blue Jays newsletter. He's also the author of a trio of baseball books, On Account of Darkness, The Howleyites, and Severn Sound, which are a fun read. Yeah, lots of... it's always so interesting with a farm system where there are the rankings and people are sometimes married to those, and those rankings are fluid. And then even within a bad system at any given time, there's like 15 guys who are killing it and 15 guys who look like they're not prospects anymore.
Yep.
So there's always so much to talk about. And obviously we would tend to focus on the positives because that's more fun and more exciting.
Absolutely.
I don't know if anyone wants to talk about like the middle infielder at high A ball who's not hitting well and you've never heard of. It would seem kind of pointless. But yeah, lots of fun stuff going on in the Blue Jays minor league system.
And that
right
was
now.
Very informative too, right? Because honestly, who has the time to follow every single level? Doug does, I guess.
Doug's primary thing.
Yeah.
And it's also
awesome. Like it's good information and it's well dissected in a way that maybe you don't get just anywhere.
So yeah.
I really appreciated that.
Yeah. Nice. And I mean, like, yeah, we are media, but like fans, and I've always done this since the days of Alex Rios, like you keep up on the box scores, but to try to fit in a regular MILB TV viewing, this is why I say it's so great that you Savage and Stanifer start on the same day or piggyback on the same day, because it's a good time to be like, okay, that's the day I got to fire up the replay of the game. I put my little notes in here about what's going on, but that's scouting the stat line and scouting the box score. You got to dig in a little further than that. Let's dig in a little further to a bunch of stuff with David Adler, Addison Barger, Alejandro Kirk, Vladimir Guerrero Jr., who are three guys who stand out in extreme ways in the new bat tracking and positioning metrics that StatCast has. David Adler is a big piece of rolling those out. He's MLB's senior coordinator of data and research. We'll take a break. We'll talk to him on the other side. We also got Ryan Dempster in the second hour as Jays Talk Plus continues with Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz.
Teeing up the biggest games of the night, it's the Fan Pregame with Ailish Forfar and Justin Cuthbert.
Weekdays at 6 p.m. on Sportsnet, Sportsnet 590 The Fan, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz with you. The Jays get ready for 3 against the Philadelphia Phillies. If we had said that a week ago, you would have said, well, that's the hottest team in baseball.
Oh, no.
The Blue Jays might be in trouble. Now they got swept by the Brewers. They've lost a handful. And the Blue Jays are one of the hotter teams in baseball. We'll see how all that shakes out. We can talk a little bit about the Blue Jays and some of the swing stuff they're doing with our next guest. It's David Adler, MLB.com Senior Coordinator of Data and Research. But David, first of all, good morning. Thanks for doing this.
Good morning to you guys. Thanks for having me.
Before we talk Major League Baseball, I wanted to ask you, you wrote about this the other day, the excitement level around Major League Baseball's partnership with Athletes Unlimited Softball League. And you wrote this up, and from an MLB perspective, it's obviously very exciting. From a baseball and softball fan perspective, it's exciting. But it was pretty fascinating to read your piece and see just how excited Major League Baseball players themselves are about this AUSL-MLB partnership.
Yeah, it's kind of cool. I mean, there's a lot of MLB players who have these connections to softball, whether they're wives, sisters, have played softball competitively their whole lives. So just, we featured a few, George Springer, JT Realmuto, and Brandon Lau. So, I mean, George Springer, his wife played softball, sisters played softball, JT Realmuto, both of his sisters were catchers even before he was. So he learned about how to play catcher from them because he was originally a shortstop when he was in high school. Brandon Lau, similar, like his whole family, or he met his wife when they were at Maryland. He was on the baseball team, she was on the softball team. So these guys, they all told these stories about, how softball has impacted their whole lives. Basically all of them were like, when we face, when we would have to hit against, our sisters or anything like that, it wasn't a fun at bat. Or like when Brandon Lau was like, I had to catch my wife's like bullpen sessions during vacations. And it was not easy to catch the movement on those pitches. So it's kind of cool just to see. And then they're all very excited about this league just to be able to showcase, the best softball players in the country. I mean, even for me, I remember when I was in, high school, and I was watching Monica Abbott and Crystal Bustos on Team USA. It's going to be cool to see, a league where these great softball players get to shine on the national stage.
Yeah, and it's gaining traction, and it seems like it's it's a well-run operation, which is always huge, right, David? You have Kim Ng as the commissioner. You have this partnership with Major League Baseball. It just seems like it's on track to actually achieve some awesome things, which is, good, overdue probably, right? It's definitely a good development. I had no idea George Springer was that into softball, to be honest with you, but it does make sense, and it kind of does illustrate, I guess, the excitement beyond the softball community. So well done. That was great work, and we're happy to hear it for sure. Your day to day job is a bit more granular, let's put it like that, than the reporting that you did there on the softball league, which is awesome as well, right? And I'm wondering just what your role right now with MLB.com entails, and how much does having a beat background help you right now with this more data and analytics driven job that you do?
Yeah, right. So my main role at MLB is as a Statcast analyst and researcher. So I kind of work with our Statcast team, kind of developing the new stats, the metrics that go up on Baseball Savant, and then write analysis pieces, kind of trying to explain, make the stats and the data, a little more, fan friendly, or sometimes just, more thorough breakdowns, depending on what the piece calls for. But yeah, like you said, my background is just reporting. I started out as an associate reporter with MLB. I covered the Rays 2014 and then the Angels and a little bit of the Dodgers in 2015. So yeah, basically my background is with writing. And then just turned out that when I first started working with MLB is when Statcast was first really launching and expanding. So I was always into that type of writing and analytical type of writing. And so, just kind of getting started with MLB at the right time, my role has really just expanded on the Statcast side since then. And now that's my main day to day, sending out research notes to, other writers or broadcasters, writing the stories myself. That's the most interesting stuff I do, because I love working with all this data that we have, all the cool Statcast stuff and these new metrics that we come out with.
And to Julia's point about your beat writing background is that you can tell, we had a great conversation with Ben Clemens last week about how we use all this new stuff, and we're not physicists, but how do we use it to tell richer stories and help people understand baseball better without getting too dragged down in it? And obviously having a writing background and a storytelling background is probably helpful for that, similar to Mike Petriello. And an example of this that we can use is you notice something in Addison Barger's swing and setup and maybe tipped someone off who works for the Blue Jays broadcast, and we get a wonderful thread about it. So I guess, we could talk about Addison Barger specifically if you'd like. And I'm also curious just how do you stumble across something like that? And what happens when you do? You just hit someone up, hey, you might find this of interest. I've got these numbers, and why don't you take a look here?
Yeah, sometimes they come to us, like was the case with Addison Barger. Sometimes we'll just see what jumps out in the data. And we're always looking at these leaderboards that we have and all this cool stat stuff. With Addison Barger, actually, you got the Blue Jays. You guys came to us asking about how he changed his stance and went, when he changed his stance and what exactly the change was. So yeah, we went back, and this new batting stance data that we came out with this year is just where every hitter's standing in the box, how open or closed their stance is, how wide or narrow their stance is, all this stuff is now tracked by Statcast. And so went and pulled up Addison Barger's, just game by game batting stances, and noticed that, on May, up till May 3rd, he had the same stance that he had before. And then on May 4th, this one game, he clearly, was trying to do something different, squared himself up to the pitcher when normally he's more open batting stance. But that only lasted one game. And you could see that clearly in the data, his open stance angle went from, 40 something degrees open to like under 10 degrees open for just one game. And then he didn't play the next couple of days after that. And then when he came, he was back in the lineup on May 7th. And he actually made a different change. His stance was even wider open than it was before. So he went like more than 50 degrees open. And he also narrowed it up a little and moved slightly further back in the box. And if you just look at the data that we have, you can see, you know, a trend for a hitter like that. And then if I go to write stories about something like that, a lot of the time I'll, you know, this is where the beat reporting background helps. Like we'll go talk to the player because, you know, the data is interesting by itself, but it's a lot more interesting if the player shares their thoughts about it. So like, for example, earlier this season, like everyone knows about Juan Soto's two strike approach and, you know, how he, you know, he widens his stance with two strikes, kind of digs in, changes how his foot position. And you could see that really clearly in the new StatCast batting stance data too. But I went to talk to him about it and, you know, he just told me like the whole history of when he started doing it in rookie ball with the Nationals and, you know, the coach who helped him because he, you know, he mandated that everyone on the Nationals had to have a specific two strike approach. And the way he did that was by changing his batting stance. And so I got the whole history of Juan Soto's batting stances, which made it way more interesting than if I had just like written a story with no player perspective, just laying out a bunch of data there.
Yeah, something else that comes to mind is Aaron Judge. You also wrote a bit about his batting stance, right, and the changes that he went through. And listen, it was interesting to hear from him as well and to read his quotes in that he's kind of just saying, well, my swing is my swing and how I get there doesn't really matter. But it kind of does, right? When you talk to a player in that sense, first of all, it must be fascinating to get their perspective. And I'm wondering how many times or how often it's not exactly what you were expecting them to say. And it's not exactly what, I guess, the results or the data is telling you.
Yeah, I mean, I tried to go into an interview not, you know, needing the answer to be one thing or the other. Like, we always know what the numbers say, but whether the hitter, you know, kind of agrees and parallels the numbers or contrasts it, it still makes for an interesting story. I mean, the best stories you write are when you get the player's thoughts, whether they, you know, agree with you, like what you might have assumed going in or not. Yeah, the Judge one, I mean, it's cool when the data kind of lines up with, you know, just the eye test, like, you know, that Aaron Judge is having like one of the most historically great, like year long runs of any hitter. And then it actually, you know, it kind of started when he changed his batting stance about a year ago and went from a more open to a more closed stance. And yeah, like what he said was that, yes, his swing is the same no matter what, but the change in the stance just kind of like gave him a little different mental cue and helped him simplify his mechanics a little bit. And, you know, it helps him get his best swing off. So it's not like the stance has no impact. Like, yeah, his swing is his swing. That, like, his swing looked the same, you know, before and after, but, you know, whatever triggers something in a hitter's mind can make a big difference, even if it's not like the swing itself.
Yeah. Sometimes it's a small thing, but it does, you can actually see how much of a difference that that makes there.
Yeah, the asking a player about something that you notice and their answer contrasts what you were thinking it was going to be is so fascinating. This came up with you. I've told the story about the Kevin Gausman splitter. So the Blue Jays had four of the top five pitchers in the league in terms of left to right, like arm side movement on splitters. So my mind immediately went to, they must be doing that intentionally if everyone on the team is doing it. And it turns out it wasn't. And like, obviously we know Kevin Gausman's splitter wants more depth and stuff. And since that conversation, he's had like his three best splitter depth games way less left to right movement. I'm like, awesome. It's still a story, but it was not the thread that I was pulling at initially. In terms of these kind of hitter swing profiles, you wrote about some of the most extreme ones for MLB.com when they came out. And there are a couple Blue Jays that come up. Alejandro Kirk, one of the flattest bat paths. I think we can all intuitively watch Alejandro Kirk and understand what that means and how it plays into Alejandro Kirk's style of hitting. And then we see Vladimir Guerrero Jr., who has one of the lowest attack angles. He's right there with Jacob Wilson, who we just saw, but that is not, you don't look at Jacob Wilson and think, oh, that's what Vlad's swing looks like, or that's what Vlad's trying to do. What do you make of Vladimir Guerrero Jr. when you dig into these numbers, having that lowest attack angle, and, you know, how well maybe it lines up with Vlad being such a good hitter, but maybe not tapping back into all of the power that we saw earlier in his career just yet?
Yeah, so we just put out these, you know, three new swing metrics that kind of describe every hitter's swing. So we have the swing path, which is, you know, basically just, do you have an uppercut or do you have a flat swing? And then we have attack angle, and attack angle is the, you know, the vertical angle that the bat is moving specifically when you make contact with the ball. So it reflects, first of all, like whether you're swinging more for fly balls, line drives, but also your timing, like how well you're timing the pitch. Because, you know, if you think about a swing, when it starts, the bat's going straight down, and then when you make contact, it's going up. So you just need your swing to be in the right place at the right time, and that's basically what attack angle is. And then we also attack direction, which is just the horizontal version of that, whether you're hitting the swinging more toward the pole side or the opposite field side. But yeah, so Vlad Jr. has, you know, one of the, actually the lowest attack angle in baseball right now, which basically means when he's making contact, his bat's traveling, you know, kind of very flat, more likely to, you know, be like a low line drive or ground ball type of swing. And I think, I mean, that kind of lines up with just the, you know, intuitively the type of balls you see him hit in general. Like, yeah, he's a big home run hitter, but he hits like a lot of frozen rope line drives. Like, that's his style. And so, yeah, like, and especially earlier in his career, like a big narrative with him was that, you know, he's hitting the ball on the ground a lot. He hits it really, really hard, but he hits it on like low. And I mean, but you know, that's his swing, like it's his style of hitting. And I like, so maybe those ground balls are just the trade-off, you know, and then you see the, you know, the 40 or 30 home run seasons when he, you know, really gets a hold of one, because if he squares the ball up, even at these low-ish attack angles, he hits it so hard and has such good bat speed that, you know, he just rips it over the fence. And that's why you see these, you know, 110, 115, almost 120 mile an hour homers that he hits. Because his bat speed is elite and his exit velocities are top of the line. So it's like, even if he's swinging pretty flat, which he has a flat swing path, and even if his attack angle is generally pretty low, when he hits the ball, when he has that high bat speed and hits the ball that hard, it's going far regardless.
And it's not, I guess, inherently a bad thing, right? David, you even had a quote in there in which he kind of says, yeah, I tried kind of, you know, switching it up a little bit and going for more launch angle, whatever. It didn't work. I didn't like it. And that's okay. He's still an extremely productive hitter.
Right. And a lot of this swing stuff, it's more just like the style of the hitter rather than just objectively good or bad. And you definitely don't want to ruin a hitter's swing by, you know, trying to put like a one size fits all approach on him. Like, not every hitter needs to launch. Not every hitter needs to be like a huge air ball hitter. For some guys that works, like, you know, like Cal Raleigh, for example, who has one of the highest attack angles and is having a, you know, monster home run season this year. But, you know, for some hitters, that's not their style, and it's like, it's fine. And I think, like, we've seen when Vlad is hot, like, he is one of the best hitters. So it's not like he needs a swing overhaul or anything, especially if, like he says, it didn't feel natural to him when he tried to do that. Like, you don't want, like, then the juice isn't worth the squeeze there. Like, you don't want to ruin the guy's swing just like because you think that hitters should do this swing this one way.
All right, but I want to do a couple quick hitters with you. Yeah. That's really great stuff on those new bat tracking metrics, which you can check more of out at MLB.com or baseballsavant.mlb.com. And by the way, the Addison Barger piece that we were talking about, I mentioned it earlier, a thread from Chris Black at Down to Black on Twitter. If you want to read a little bit more about that, see what it looks like in terms of his mechanics side by side. David, I sat down to read your hitter power rankings this morning, and I thought maybe you'd pat yourself on the back and pat myself on the back for James Wood's success this year. I know he was someone you had tabbed as a potential breakout this year. He was only an honorable mention on the hitter power rankings. How cool has it been to see James Wood kind of one of these guys that was so toolsed up on the way up, and you wonder, you know, when is the production going to come and how, to what degree it's going to come? And now he's been one of the better power hitters in the early going so far this year.
Well, it's awesome to watch, especially me as a, you know, Statcast guy. You see the numbers he puts up. I mean, first of all, like, just a fun hitter to watch. Like, we don't need to, like, it's not just that he has cool data, but yeah, like huge dude, like kind of built in the mold of like these, you know, current young stars, like, you know, big guys like Ellie De La Cruz, O'Neill Cruz, like, but big but fast. So he has that like power, speed, size thing going on, and then I think it's really cool to just like to watch the types of home runs. He hits tons of balls to the opposite field. Like, first month of the season, he was going through this weeks long stretch where he just like hadn't pulled one fly ball. And that's cool because it's, you know, so, you know, counter to the style of power hitting we see in MLB these days.
He hates Isak Paredes is what you're saying. He would just loathe that guy.
Right. He's like the exact opposite. Like he's a greatest. He's never hit a home run that's not pulled. And James Wood was hitting all these to left center. And and he hits it hard. He crushes it. Very fun hitter to watch. Just like from a fan perspective, just eyeballs on him and from the data too.
Yeah. Someone else that was on that list is Kyle Schwarber. And I feel like we should.
Yeah,
and Kyle Schwarber, considering we're going to see him. Was he number six?
Yes.
Number six on the rankings. And listen, it's been a season for Schwarber so far. 300th home run of his career. He's hitting lefties. How have you seen sort of the evolution of Schwarber and what he's done so far this season here, David?
Yeah, so basically with Schwarber, it's like he's a much more complete hitter than he's been before, you know, like more discipline, more contact, and, you know, he always mashes. So, but it's not just that, it's like home runs or bust. He's kind of more well-rounded. I think one of my colleagues, Tom Harrigan, he wrote a nice little breakdown of Kyle Schwarber a few weeks ago, like kind of breaking this down. But yeah, like, sure, like he'll still swing and miss, but like he's just been a much more valuable, like all around hitter this year. And I also like, you know, when he bats the leadoff and hits leadoff home runs, it's kind of fun to see just like a beefy leadoff guy hitting bombs like that. But I mean, if you just look at his numbers, he's great. He doesn't chase bad pitches. He's got great bat speed. You know, he rips the ball. So he's disciplined. He walks a ton. So he's a fun hitter to watch, and especially when he gets a hold of one, because it still goes just as far as it ever did.
Yeah, it's that hitter profile having a 94th percentile chase rate, swinging at fewer than 20% of the pitches out of the zone. Obviously, the next, once you have established the power, the key is to try to bring the pitcher into the zone so they have to pitch to where you can hit for power. And it's fascinating to the degree to which he's been able to do that always, but especially this year. And I made the point earlier, if you're Bowden Francis, like, you're so happy he's not hitting leadoff right now, because it seems like the most uncomfortable way to start a game to have that guy to have that guy up there.
Yeah, the discipline, I think, is a big thing for him, the not chasing, because like when he does swing, you know, his bat speed is really high and he hits the ball really hard. So if he's picking the right pitches to swing at, then he's really going to mash them. And like you said, like he wants to bring the pitchers into the zone. Like, especially like when you see like what Bryce Harper goes through, where like pitchers just don't throw him strikes. Like he just never sees balls in the zone. Schwarber is not like extreme like that. He does get more pitches in the zone, but like when he's not chasing balls, like, pitchers really can't you can't be throwing him meatballs if those are the, and if, especially if he's attacking them like this and not swinging at bad pitches.
Yeah, it's pretty ridiculous. 10 homers in the month of May. Good luck to Bowden Francis and the rest of the Blue Jays tonight. David, thanks so much for doing this, man. Thank you for taking the time out, and keep up all the great work.
Oh, thank you guys again for having me.
David Adler, MLB.com, Senior Coordinator of Data and Research. All of that stuff is available at baseballsavant.mlb.com. His writing is up at MLB.com as well. It was a little far back, so we didn't get to it, but a terrific early season breakdown on Jung-Hoo Lee, who is one of April's breakout stars. He's cooled off a lot since then, but if you want to, you know, what good storytelling about swing changes looks like, matching the visual with quotes from the player and things like that, about the best you could do it. And again, that Addison Barger thread we talked about with David is available at Down to Black on Chris Black's Twitter. He kind of took some of those new metrics and showed exactly what Addison Barger has tweaked at the plate. He's always hit the ball really hard, but now he's, you know, he's looking a little different in the box and getting to that power a little easier, I guess. I hesitate to use the word easy sometimes because none of this is easy. Like hitting a 95 mile an hour fastball down the middle is not easy, even if your mechanics are perfect. But by his standards, getting to it a little easier.
Yeah, and more and turning himself into a more prolific guy as well, right? Instead of trying to pull everything, something that Joe alluded to, of course, in our first segment here.
Yeah. Also something that comes easy, Ryan Dempster's velocity still. He threw out the first pitch at the Cubs game last week, right down the middle. Also launched one into the bleachers, which if I were a former player, throwing one down the plate is one thing, but the full-on long toss into the crowd, it might be one where my shoulder Well, let's be honest. My elbow would be barking given the state that it is currently in right now. But yeah, were I Ryan Dempster, it would be sore. Let's take a break. Let's talk to Ryan Dempster, obviously a legend in Canadian baseball and someone who's gotten a good look at the Cubs and a good look at the Phillies over the last little bit. So we'll continue to set this series up, go around the NL a little bit. Ryan Dempster joins us next as Jays Talk Plus continues with Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz.
Unrivaled insight, analysis, and opinions on all things Blue Jays. Blair and Barker. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz with you. Jays and Phillies start a three-set tonight down at Rogers Center. Christopher Sanchez against Bowden Francis. Pretty good Phillies team. Not the best bullpen. If they need some help, our next guest looked pretty good throwing out the first pitch recently. Of Intentional Talk on MLB Network and Marquee, two-time All-Star, former Tip O'Neill Award winner, Ryan Dempster joins us now. Ryan, how you doing, man?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for coming on. How'd it feel throwing the first pitch out of the Cubs game last week? Looked like you still got it.
Yeah, it felt great. I got some good warm-ups. Juan Cabrera or one of our coaches underneath warmed me up nice and well. Sort of the my other good friend, I don't know if you know Jose Cuervo and Jack Daniels, they made sure I was funny stretched out before I threw that first pitch out.
Oh, that's so awesome, Ryan. You did that, and then you sang Take Me Out to the Ball Game in the seventh inning stretch. Fun stuff, and I'm wondering what was more high stress, let's put it like that, if it was doing either of those things or going undercover as a Cardinals fan. It seemed like people were pretty nice about that overall.
Yeah, definitely. You know, between the pitch and the stretch at Wrigley, I knew as long as I didn't bounce it, everything else was good. And you can just sing your heart up there. The Cardinal thing, you know, I was a little nervous because I got some heat a few years ago when I had Chris Bryant on my Off the Mound show and he said that St. Louis was boring. I agreed with them. Yachty was yelling at us on social media. But the Cardinal fans are great. I've always loved going there and to go undercover rival and a bit we did for booking.com, go full costume as Roger from Fayetteville, Arkansas was a lot of fun. And I'm glad that until I ran into the people from Arkansas and they're like, really, whereabouts? I did my research. I knew a couple cross streets and Moss's tap room. So I just threw those out there and that worked out well.
That was great. You got an acting future there as well. Seriously. The wig looked great. The bit was great. And not to just keep pumping your tires, but I also saw you performed with the Lindberghers after Cubs Sox the other week as well. You got on the mic and belted it out.
Yeah, we did. We did some glory days. You know, nice. Much like we're talking about now, the good old days. It was a lot of fun. Matt Spiegel and the Lindberghers, very talented band. And I showed up, and they were very tight and on point, and he's like, you're going to get up and sing. And I was like, Jesus, with you guys? Okay, I'm going to have to really be ready. But we had a blast, and it was a good time.
Yeah, it's great. The Cubs also swept the White Sox that series, which you probably expect given how those two teams have gone this year. Do want to talk a little Phillies with you, but I know you're all over the Cubs as well at Marquee. 37-22, took two off the Reds twice in a row, sandwiched around a sweep of the Rockies. Do you think the Cubs at this point should kind of be in the conversation as the best team in baseball, maybe at least the best team in the National League?
Yeah, I mean, you look at the records across the board. I mean, you know, I know on paper we fall in love with lineups on paper. It happens every year. We fall in love with what it looks like. And the Dodgers have three MVPs on their team and four, actually, if you include Kershaw. So they, you know, they go down the list. And the Mets, and they got Juan Soto and Francisco Lindor. Well, cool, man. The Chicago Cubs are sitting here, you know, one less win than the best team in the National League, the Mets. So you got to put themselves in that conversation, and it hasn't slowed up. And I know it's early. If you're just going to base it on the first 2 months of the season, given the fact that they went to Japan, flew back, then went to California, they were out west for the start of the season, then you go back to Central, back home, and then back out west. It's been a tough schedule against good teams, and then they've had a softer schedule lately. Well, awesome. What are they doing? They're beating those softer teams. Some teams fall down to that competition. It tells me a lot about their ball club. They can score runs. They can pitch. And their pitching hasn't even been as good as they wanted to be. So, yeah, I put them in that conversation. Definitely, you know, a top 3 team in the National League,
yeah,
in my opinion.
Their pitching maybe hasn't been as good yet, and it hasn't really needed to be because this offense is probably top three in all of the majors right now. Just extremely deep lineup, it feels like here, Ryan. How tough is that lineup to pitch to?
Yeah, this is one thing I said. I got asked a month ago, what's one thing that you're certain about with the Chicago Cubs? And I said, I'm certain they will continue to score runs because I look at this lineup as a team that can do it with the long ball. They can do it by being tough with two outs, with two strikes. Frank Council said they hold it before every single game. They hold a hitter's meeting, which he is included in. They talk about approach to that day. What is the approach against the pitching staff? What is the approach to the other team? You know, whether that's conditional, right? Is the wind blowing in? Okay, guys, listen, we're not going to hit home runs today. So let's make sure we're tough with two strikes. Let's make sure we're going the other way. Let's make sure we're getting the runner over, getting the guy in, getting the lead. All of these things are important for your offense to click. And then they have the ability to steal bases. I mean, you go up and down the list on the team of stolen bases. I mean, you got 19, 16, 11, 8, 7. They go down the list. These guys, they can steal bags. So I think they're going to continue to score runs. And that has taken the pressure off of a pitching staff that has dealt with both injuries, loss to your two top pitchers. But some other guys have stepped up nicely, and some other guys have gotten some opportunities.
One of those guys who's stepped up nicely, this is a Canadian show, so obviously want to highlight Jameson Taillon, who at 33, having another really solid season, 3.76 ERA, strung together a couple of really good starts in a row. Obviously, he's always flashed it throughout his career, and most of the time when he's been healthy, he's been really effective. But what have you seen from him in kind of the maturity these last 2 years to kind of settle in as he's a steady vet, and every time out, you're getting kind of the same version of Jameson Taillon?
Yeah, it's just been fun. I love J-Mo, man. He loves talking pitching. You know, he's a guy that, you know, he's not going to go deep into ball games for you, but he goes, you know, somewhere in the 5 to 7 innings every game, and he gives you a chance to win. And he throws the ball over the plate. Sure, gives up home runs. Yeah, solos. And sometimes, like, that outing, if he starts back against the Marlins, that was enough to beat you. Give him 4 hits, 3 solo home runs. Didn't score any runs. So that's how it goes. But he doesn't walk guys. He comes after you. Stuff has declined a little bit. Father Time starts to catch up with us all. But what does he do? He counterbalances that by continuing to attack the strike zone and changing speeds. And, like, I adapt to the metrics that have gone on, and we all fall in love with the strikeout, right? It's so beautiful, isn't it? It's so great. It's so awesome. We just love it. Who's leading the team in strikeouts? Ben Brown. Ben Brown has a 5.72 ERA. So what do you want? Do you want the guy who gets out and does it efficiently, or do you want the sexiness of the strikeout? Because it might lead to something special, but it also might lead to him giving up 9 runs. So, like, I love when a guy goes out there and just executes pitches and changes speeds and pitches to all the quadrants of the strike zone. I think it's a beautiful, masterful thing that still works in today's game that we're so highly focused on the strikeout with. I think it's awesome, and I love that J-Mo goes about his business the way he does.
Yeah, that self-awareness, I guess, can lead to a prolific, I guess, adjustment, right? Even if you are seeing a decline in stuff and all of that, and that is... That is awesome to see, Ryan, and obviously a big part of the Cubs' success there. Another team that is firmly in the argument here for best team, at least in the National League, are the Phillies, who are coming in for a 3-game set here with the Blue Jays. Not the best weekend of the season for the Phillies, but given just, I guess, how well-constructed this lineup is and even the fact that the rotation has been really good, you kind of just chalk it up to a bad weekend, right? This is still a very, very good Phillies team.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, offensively, a team that if you would have sat there and said, hey, on June, what are we on, the 3rd now, June 4th, whatever it is today, June 3rd, that Bryce Harper's going to have 8 home runs and the Phillies are going to have their record, you'd be like, no, but, like, Kyle Schwarber is having an MVP-type season for them. But he's the only player on their entire roster with more than 8 home runs. That's crazy when you look at their lineup. And so really they've done it in a couple different ways. They've done it with good pitching, and that's without having Nola. You know, they've done it with Zach Wheeler, who's such a stud, and Lizardo, until his last outing, has been one of the most dominant pitchers in baseball. They lost their closer, yet they continue to win ball games. I think that's a testament to the guy, the captain of the ship, Rob Thompson. He gets these guys ready to go. They Trey Turner's hot. You know, he's gotten it back on track. So they know how to win ball games. Their goal is, you know, the long run. It's not being the best team in June. It's to get to the postseason and get back to the promised land and try and get to a World Series. So they've mixed and matched throughout it. But, yeah, they've hit a little bit of a downturn, but that's kind of been their season. They started out down. They got really hot, and they're in this four-game losing streak. And so you're kind of hitting them if you're Toronto at the right time right now. Yeah.
Rob Thompson, of course, Canadian as well. So let's keep
what
it on
day.
That note. Yeah, lots of CanCon today. Ryan, it's probably, I'd imagine your experience coming to Toronto to pitch was a little different than what Jordan Romano's will be like this week, because Jordan Romano has played for the Blue Jays before, but he is coming back in here as a visitor. What was your experience the two times you got to pitch in Toronto? What was it? What? And I know you pitched in Montreal a handful of times earlier in your career as well, but a little later on when you got to come to Toronto, what do you remember about that?
It's just special, man. It's like, you know, because there's only a few of us in the major leagues, you know, there's only a few of us in the minor leagues. There's not a lot of Canadian baseball players. There's more than there was before, but there's still, it's not like we're sitting here and we're like, from the Dominican, we're almost half the league Latin. Like, no, it's like we see each other from across the field. Like, I'd be running poles, and I'm like, there's more Noah over there. I wonder if he's got any ketchup chips on him. You know, it's like we get excited when we see other Canadians. And so to come back to Canada, where there's so much of your life and your history and your core of you, where you're from, it was special for me. It was always meant a lot. I think, I know in Montreal, but I'm pretty sure in Toronto, I think I'm undefeated. Never lost a game on Canadian soil, which is like one of my favorite stats I have. It was always just this little bit extra, whether that was people back home being able to watch, whether that was fellow countrymen in the stands, you were home, and it was special. And it just meant a little bit more. And I'm sure for Rob, like, I mean, we saw he went to the Canadian Baseball Hall of Fame on an off day with some of the guys. Like, it's just, it means more. And it's special to see. So, you know, it's always great being able to go back to our wonderful country and pitch there.
Yeah, you were 6-0 across Toronto and Montreal. Phew. With ridiculous. Sorry, like, you had a 1.38 ERA in Toronto.
I'm just saying. And they never once, like, I'm sorry, it wasn't the guys currently running the regime, but, like, I think it was maybe J.P. Ricciardi, and then it was Alex. Like, I was a free agent. They didn't even call.
Come on.
They never, I swear to God, they never said, let's get the Canadian kid up here who's never lost here with a sub-2 ERA to come pitch here. And I'm like, I was waiting for it. I'm like, my agent was talking to me, and I'm like, wait. Nobody, they didn't call, not one. I never lost in that country. They could just pitch me for home games, and I'd go 32-0.
Well,
man.
You did pretty well, Ryan. I would say that it was their loss.
It worked out, yes. I would agree.
And, you know, staying on the Jays then, I'm just wondering what your impressions have been about this team a little bit from afar. Obviously, I understand that you may not be as locked in, but, yeah, some ups and downs here as well. What have you seen from the Blue Jays?
Yeah, definitely. I was a little concerned early on. You know, there was just not quite where they needed to be. And you worry that you get out of it too far. But they did a good job of kind of just making their way through it. And they've gotten, you know, gotten better and better, riding this really great winning streak right now and getting contributions out of some young guys. I mean, Vladdy has just continued to crush the baseball, and good pitching as of late, good bullpen, like, winning formula. And I think, you know, that's a really great thing when you got the Blue Jays doing well. The Rogers Center, when the Blue Jays are doing well, people start to show up. And then you get big series like this, the Phillies, and these teams come in. That place is one of the top five places in the league to play when it's packed. It is loud. It is home field advantage at its finest. And I love it. And I hope it continues for you know, my family back home, my friends back home who love the Blue Jays. It's great, man, and good for them for putting themselves now in a position where, you know, I mean, chasing the Yankees. And listen, hey, man, they're gettable, right? Like, they've had some injuries. Now they lose their closer. The Yankees lose their closer for 4 to 6 weeks. Go keep this going. Keep it rolling. Make it fun for the summer.
Yeah, should be a blast. It'll be a tough one. I mean, this is a Phillies team that even with Zach Wheeler hit the paternity list today, so they won't see him. But you said the other day that this is possibly the best rotation in all of baseball. The Jays are going to see Christopher Sanchez today, but I wanted to ask you about Jesus Luzardo, who they're going to see later in the, and I know you guys had Christian Yelich on the show, and that was a fun week for the Brewers and a fun sweep for the Brewers. If you are Luzardo and you had been having such a great season and you give up a 12 spot on the weekend, what is the process like for trying to bounce back from that next time out and not have that in your head?
Yeah, I think you almost can't believe it, given the start of this. You started your season. It's like, what just happened? Was I in the Matrix for a moment? Like, did something happen there? Like, I don't even know what happened. Like, if you've been giving up, like, if you're sitting with, like, a 4.5 and you give up 12, now you're, like, you're concerned and you're starting to second-guess yourself all over the place. But he's been doing so well. It's almost like this weird hiccup that everything just went their way. Every pitch he threw, they hit. I expect him to be really sharp next time out and bounce back from that. And so you have to be ready for that. Hey, listen, when you're playing good baseball, that's what happens. The Blue Jays are playing good baseball right now. You find ways to win games instead of finding ways to lose games. It's, you know, coming up, you get guys who get clutch hits when it matters, you know, guys are driving in runs when it matters. Like, and they're swinging the bat really, really well right now. Like guys like Alejandro Kirk and George Springer's, you know, having a solid year and stuff like that. And, you know, average wise, home run wise, but contributing. Right. And it's good to see when kind of everybody's doing a little something, a different guy every day. And it's not always just the same guy. It's not on Vladdy's shoulders every day or Bo's shoulders every day to go out there. It's everybody contributing in a different way, whether that's Clement or Barger or these guys. So yeah, it's when you're going good, dude, it doesn't matter who you're playing, who's pitching, you feel like you can beat anybody.
Yeah, for all the talk of bad luck, especially early in the season, and then we have Max Scherzer, he joined the broadcast one day, Ryan, and he's talking about creating your own luck and all of that. It does seem like the Blue Jays luck has turned a little bit, and that is probably also, you know, a little bit man-made, if you will. But before we let you go here, Ryan, we did want to say congratulations, 30-year anniversary of your draft a couple of days ago. And, you know, kind of just wondering, as you look back 30 years later, how do you feel? Are there snapshots? Can you see it, you know, in a more holistic way? That's a pretty big milestone, I guess, to reach that 30-year anniversary.
Yeah, one, I'm just thankful I'm still here with you, talk on the phone. But I remember it vividly. I remember being at shout out Sergeant Hill, the police sergeant who my dad was with, fire chief. We were renting their house at the time, and at the end of Sergeant Road, and the phone call came in, and I was kind of monitoring the draft on the internet, and so I could see that it was past the second round, and I knew that the Rangers, Dodgers, and Expos were three teams that were, once again, the Blue Jays, no thought, thank you guys. But those three teams were really kind of highly on me. And so the Rangers picked seventh, and I had a feeling. And then I got a phone call from Tim Holmgren, my scout from the Rangers, and he called me and said, congratulations, you're the seventh pick of the third round. I think it was 60th overall after a couple sandwich picks in there. And it was awesome. My parents let me stay home from school that day. I thought it would have been cooler to be at school and somebody like a principal pulled me out, you know, and I could have shown off in front of my friends. But instead, my parents let me take the day off, and then me and some buddies went out and golfed at Sunshine Coast Country Club that afternoon, and that was the beginning of it, right? The beginning of the whole journey that's led me to here right now. So it was just an incredible day when you're, you know, a teenage kid, and those things start to come into your mind that this might actually be a possibility, and then to have that happen was magical. I was dropped by the Texas Rangers. I loved Nolan Ryan. He was my idol, and like, He was, you know, Mr. Texas Ranger. It was just all surreal, special, and I can't believe it's already been 30 years. And, you know, I've been involved in the game both as a player, front office, and now as a broadcaster, and I still haven't had to have a real job since that phone call. So it's been pretty incredible.
That's awesome. That's great to hear you reflect on that. And, yeah, congrats again, Ryan. That's a great 30 years, and we're glad you're still doing it from the broadcast perspective. It was great chatting with you.
I appreciate you guys having me on. It was a lot of fun. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Ryan Dempster of Intentional Talk on MLB Network, also Marquee. And yeah, Alpha Stone High School in Gibbons, British Columbia. Gibson's, British Columbia.
What a story.
This is how well I know my small town BC geography.
I don't think anyone
It's
will,
no Abbotsford, but it'll it'll do. No, Ryan Dempster, awesome. Just it's funny that he mentioned multiple times that the Jays didn't have injuries.
Yeah.
Like legitimately, we've gone through this on the basketball side over the years too, where when there were only a few Canadians in the league, everyone would always attach the Raptors to them. Like, of course the Raptors would be interested. And now they've had a bunch of Canadians over the years, but it's mostly because there are so many Canadians in the league now. But in baseball, we're still at a spot where there aren't a ton. That's why we get excited about Sam Shaw from Victoria having a really good start to his minor league season, but never gave old Ryan Dempster the call. you don't think the Blue Jays could have used some pitching help from the years 1998 to 2013?
I would imagine
I don't remember those staffs being the class of the league anywhere in there.
Oh, yeah, that was pretty funny, though. But I am pretty happy that we get to hear those stories from just, you know, the surreal moment of being a teenager and then getting drafted and then saying, let's go golf as a celebration with your buddies. Like, sure.
Yeah, I mean, I guess what else would you do, right? Like he had to report. And I guess this still happens, but a lot of times now with how big the complexes are and the developmental lists and stuff like that, a lot of times we won't see a high school draft pick play in affiliated ball that year.
Yep.
They'll just be down at the complex working. He was in not only rookie ball later that summer, but low A by the end of that summer. So he got drafted in June while he's still in high school. And by September, he was playing low A ball.
That's
so
awesome.
I don't think you could... I don't know. Maybe you could tilt back one or two.
Yeah.
But you got to get right back to work after
you
that round of
to.
Golf.
Absolutely. Also, as a teenager, you shouldn't. But that's separate. Yeah.
This will surprise a lot of people, given the beersman I am now. But I did not as a teenager.
Oh, yeah?
I didn't. No, not at all.
You also didn't get drafted, so.
No. That was unrelated. That was it. Now, were there a draft for future potential beersmen? Number one pick.
You had the potential always.
Yes, it was. It was in me. Okay. Phillies Jays start a three set tonight. 7:07 at Rogers Center. Bowden Francis against Christopher Sanchez. The rest of the series is Jose Berríos against Mick Abel, who will come up from AAA. Chris Bassett against Jesus Luzardo. And I say Mick Abel will come up from AAA because if the Phillies wanted, they could add a 10th reliever today. They're already rolling with 9 because the rotation is a man short with Mick Abel. Taiwan Walker moving to what we expect will be a leverage role in the bullpen to help out with the loss of Jose Alvarado there. Zach Wheeler's on the paternity list, and they don't have to activate Mick Abel until tomorrow. So they could add a 10th reliever if they really wanted to, flight prices being what they are and everything. I don't know if they actually will. We are also expecting Bryce Harper back tonight, as I mentioned a little bit earlier. He's missed the last 5 games after taking 95 miles an hour from Spencer Strider off the elbow. His comments Sunday were that he was feeling a little better and expects to play tonight. On the Blue Jays side, the expectation as of Sunday was that today we will see the activation of Andrés Giménez and Tyler Heineman. The Tyler Heineman move is obvious. Ali Sanchez goes down. Now, whether he gets optioned or designated for assignment once they need another 40-man spot, we'll see. They don't imminently need a 40-man spot, so they can, you know, option him for the time being. The other interesting one, though, is what they do with Andrés Giménez coming off, because in terms of what pitchers are coming up, who you want to see get some run, what the platoons look like, Davis Schneider makes more sense.
Absolutely.
Michael Stefanik does not have options, though. Davis Schneider does. It would be a little bit of a pull the rug out to call Davis Schneider up only for one game, but that is a consideration. You'd have to expose Stefanik to waivers and to the DFA process.
It's definitely a consideration. I'd still say that if you want to invest in the talent that you have grown, then maybe give Davis Schneider another chance here, but we'll see. Can't really predict it, honestly.
Yeah, I misspoke, by the way. Ali Sanchez does not have options, so he would have to be exposed to waivers as well, but that's going to happen. That is,
they're
not going to send down Kirk.
Yeah.
They're not going to carry 3 catchers with all the outfield holes that they have. So it should be fascinating to see how the lineups shake out, not just tonight, but Thursday as well. So 2 lefties now on the docket for this Philly series, and then a weekend full of righties. I think we have a decent handle what the lineup looks like against righties, even with Varsho and Santander down. And Giménez back, but how it looks against lefties will be pretty fascinating. Christopher Sanchez is a tough lefty, comes in with a 3.32 ERA, 3.48 underlying. This is his third year in a row with really good underlying numbers. His strikeout rate is up to a career high. And the big thing with Christopher Sanchez, the strikeouts are nice. Striking out 28% of the batters, great. Always, always, always a big ground ball guy. The sinker, you can hit it. the league is hitting 300 against it, but you cannot put it in the air. It'll get a ton of ground balls. And then the changeup is a huge swing and miss pitch, but also most of the contact you make against it is on the ground. So maybe you sit looking for the slider, which he doesn't throw, you know, quite as much, but that's the only pitch you can get some lift into. I don't know. You might have to string together some singles in this one. Bowden Francis will try to keep the ball in the ballpark against a tough lineup. A bunch of Phillies do pretty well hitting the long ball as lefties against right-handed pitching. Bryce Harper, Kyle Schwarber. Yeah, a lot of guys in there. Bowden Francis comes in with a 5.04 ERA. So it could be a tough one, but hopefully he can build on that last good start. Thank you to Joe Siddle, Doug Fox, David Adler, and Ryan Dempster for joining us. Thank you to Amit Mon, Austin Mackey, Jennifer Rolnick, and the other voice I heard in my headphones behind the glass. We'll be back at 10 a.m. to break it down. Have a wonderful Tuesday.